Hey, mister. What happened to the car?
What do you think happened?
Looks like it was chewed up and spat out.
Perhaps it was a result of anxiety.
All right. So here's the first live stream. I'm going to get on with this because I want to be more concise than my usual 4-hour videos, if you've seen some of the other ones. But I want to talk a little bit about this idea, and then I want to talk about moving forward, what's happening, and then also just what we're covering today. It's going to be 30 minutes, maybe. That's what I'm aiming for. I always go longer than that. But so if this is the first time watching, I have videos that I make, started out with right-wing extremism, and it just blew up into a lot of different things because I have a background in political science and history, and I saw, as well as activism, and I just saw a lot of garbage out there. Some of the areas of specialties I had were Ukrainian history as well as Jewish history. So, you know, these are two hot button things when you think about the last few years, whether we start with Syria and COVID and then Ukraine and what's happening now. That kind of drove me away from domestic terrorism, tracking right-wing extremism in the MAGA world, things like that. And so that's where I'm at. Some of my videos, things on Ukraine, for instance, or ideology of someone like Alexander Dugin, are multiple hours long. And so when events started to happen surrounding Israel and Gaza, I said, well, I'm going to make another video. So most of my videos are on PowerPoint. And the PowerPoint that I was going to use right now has over 245 slides on it. So I said, well, that's even crazy for me. And I've put out their 3.5-hour videos. So instead of that, what I'm going to do is take all those slides and turn them into writing. So something like a self-published book or extremely, extremely ridiculously long article is probably what I'm thinking about, because a lot of the things that we see happening, not in the actual conflict or the people in the conflict, but surrounding the conflict, are things that we've seen happen over and over again over the past decade or so, you know, even a little bit longer. And so that's really what I'm interested in terms of that research. To not go quiet and to keep this thing going, what I decided on is to just set these up maybe once a month, and we'll see, you know, maybe more, maybe less. And just talk about little pieces of what it is that I'm researching in this larger project, because I can't do that as well as different content for this. I don't have the bandwidth for that. So that's where this idea for October 7th came in. And that's what we're talking about today. Even in looking at that, you can't talk about October 7th in 30, 40 minutes. This is going to go over an hour. I mean, who am I kidding? But you can talk about pieces of it. And I think what will end up happening after looking at what I want to talk about, which is not like a historical A to Z of events or geopolitics, right? But different angles and perspectives on what's happening. What I wanted to talk about was, yes, it's happening, was specific pieces of it. So this is going to be a topic probably for the next three, let's say, right? The next three of these, and we'll see, maybe even a little bit more. Okay, so enough of all of that. If you're watching this, you probably know that already. And if you don't, you probably clicked past this anyway. So let's get into October 7th. So there's just so much surrounding this topic, but, you know, I thought about where can we start? And again, I have 200, 45 or something slides and double digit documents just filled with links about many different things that I'm working on. But I think that probably, you know, without going into history, without going into the belligerents involved, whether it's Israel or different iterations of organizations that represent the Palestinian people, I think that Hamas is probably the place to start. I might be wrong, but that's where I am starting. And before delving into it, I've had communication with some people. And if anyone who sees this is aware of folks that maybe I should be in communication with, whether they're academics or researchers or people that are just on social media and have a plethora of knowledge, let me know, because I'm definitely open to it. But in discussing this, one of the things that, you know, we talk about often is how to critique an organization like Hamas and an event like October 7th without falling into traps of, well, what about Hamas, right? Or, well, you know, true, Israel's forcibly trying to depopulate, you know, Gaza for its own current right-wing Likud government reasons, but Hamas, right? And so that's not what this is about. This is more about, at least for right now, trying to understand where Hamas came from, because that can inform what Hamas is today. Again, differentiating, because just because Hamas came from these things, it doesn't mean that that's what they are today, but understanding where they came from to see how that can inform things. And then once we understand that, maybe next time, look into events that led up to October 7th, and then look at what Hamas and some of the other groups that were involved have to say about it, right? And whether it's in their own defense or whether it's them pleading their case. But so that seemed like a nice structure, you know, and a way to go about it. All right. So if we're going to start with Hamas and understanding why, again, the why is so that we're informed about maybe some of the views or reasons for internally, not externally and through events, but internally about what informed the decision for October 7th to happen, we need to talk about the origins, right? So again, without going into history, which I can be prone to do, I've given some hellish winter session lectures that are 2.5 hours. I think we can be concise. So first of all, Hamas is an acronym, and that's important because people say Hamas and they don't really understand what it means. So Hamas is an acronym for the translated Islamic resistance movement. And that's a key feature of Hamas. That's something that I'll probably end up going back to over and over again. The idea that, yes, it's a nationalist movement. Yes, it's a liberation movement. Yes, you can argue maybe it's an anti-imperialist movement. But above all, at its core, and why it really came to be in the first place, is that it's rooted in Islamic resistance. And it's key. And we'll see why as we continue. So there's Hamas, which is all of the things above that I just mentioned, but also it has a military arm as well. So it has the Al-Aqsa Brigades. Sometimes messaging, especially if you're on social media, will be little clips, little videos or quotes, and it can be a little confusing. So messaging from Al-Aqsa Brigade sometimes isn't necessarily in line with Hamas, and sometimes even with the leadership of Hamas, they're not always in line with each other too. So, you know, we have to understand what it is that we're talking about, which is a very broad movement at this time that has a lot of different parts and sects to it, that over the past, well, since the 1980s, right, has really grown and has internal divisions as well. Okay, so if we're talking about the 1980s and Hamas, that's when Hamas came to be. And it came out of a charity. So translated, the charity that Hamas came out of is called the Islamic Center. I'm not even going to try to give the correct pronunciation, but in English, it's the Islamic Center. And it was an arm of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so when I say the 1980s, I'm not saying that because it's the 1980s and it's a great decade. It's because during the 1980s, that was the first intifada. So there's three big parts there to kind of unpack about what Hamas is all about, right? Hamas came out of a charity organization. So that's less about the Islamic Center or the charity or what it did, but it's more to understand that Hamas was something else, right? Or Hamas came out of a previous entity. And it came out of that previous entity for a reason. Hamas came from via the Islamic Center, the Muslim Brotherhood. So we need to know what they're about as well. And really, the reason for change, the reason from moving away from the Islamic Center into Hamas was the events, and not just the external events and violence, but the social change, the psychological change, and the political changes that were happening, especially in Gaza during that first intifada. So talking about the first intifada, right? This began in 1987, and it never really ended because it wasn't like an official war. I have different resources say different things. I tend to go with when the Oslo Accords began in the early 1990s. Of course, there's sporadic violence occurring all the time. And so what's intifada, what's not? But it's generally early 1990s, 93, it ended. And it was in this environment that Hamas was formed or it originated. So this is important because it tells us a little bit about what the organization is about, whether it's the organization as just the paramilitary force, or it's the organization that is a governing force, as well as a paramilitary force, as well as some other things. But this is where it was birthed out of. And so there are still people within it who came out of this era, right? There was another intifada as well, and that was from 2000 to 2005. There were a lot of provocations that caused that, but generally, it was frustration over the lack of any kind of final agreement. If we're going back to, I just said, the Oslo Accords in 1993, the lack of any movement of the peace process that was occurring throughout the late 1980s and 1990s. So the Oslo Accords happened. We'll talk about them a little bit. But for the people in Gaza and the West Bank, they didn't see things improving. And for some people, they saw things get worse, actually. So this is when the second intifada happened, and then very important events occurred directly after that involving Hamas actually winning elections and having to figure that out. But again, we're talking about where Hamas comes from and how they change. They were birthed out of the first intifada, which was an uprising. So they moved from a charity to a paramilitary organization. The second intifada happened in 2000 and 2005, and out of that, elections occurred. And they once again kind of changed the way that they're operating. But we'll see, even in that attempt to change, it didn't really go that smoothly. And they stuck to a lot of their very core principles, one of those being the unwillingness to accept a two-state solution, right? Which really kind of gets down to the nuts and bolts of it. And even how do you describe this, right? A two-state solution. Some people argue that, you know, that's not even proper language, because what this really is that it's all just occupation, right? And they're a liberation movement, and they're fighting against occupation. So if other groups want to work with the occupation, they can, right? But I'm going to go ahead and use the two-state solution because it juxtaposes the alternative, which is a unitary state of Palestine. So the Muslim Brotherhood, getting back to them, this entity goes way back, all right? So we're talking the early 1900s, 1920s. They became more familiar, though, and this is my opinion, in the U.S. You know, you didn't really hear a whole lot about the Muslim Brotherhood in the U.S. until 2010, 2011, and this is because of the Arab Spring. So there was a lot of reporting that just propped up after the Egyptian revolution against Mubarak about, well, who are the Muslim Brotherhood? Some of it was accurate, some of it was fear-mongering, some of it was appropriate, right? But it was out of this organization that the Islamic Center and then Hamas came from. And Hamas still in their documents today make references to the Brotherhood. So they're relevant in understanding how Hamas thinks, which again informs us on what was going on October 7th. The Brotherhood's main goals, you know, there are different goals historically. They are centered in Egypt, and so they were, it could be said that they were an anti-colonial force because they opposed British intervention in Egypt. They could be said to be a kind of Muslim organization, Islamic organization that proposed Sharia law, that proposed creating an Islamic caliphate in the region. So Sharia law, meaning law based on Islamic texts, documents, the Quran, religious texts, etc., or a caliphate referencing kind of historical organization in the region of how these of how Islamic and Muslim peoples organize. And that's really important because I want to stop there for talking about informing, right, about what Hamas is. Without going to, without trying to fit a square peg in a round hole to make a narrative that doesn't exist, there is something to be said if we're talking about the Muslim Brotherhood and this idea of a caliphate, because it's not only the Muslim Brotherhood that talks about that. Hamas has talked about that, and other Islamic organizations have talked about that too. If we're looking at this in an Islamic revolutionary sense and incorporating aspects of, in their view, anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism through the lens of Islamic resistance, there was a time before the 20th century in which the Middle East fared very well against intruders. And when you date back to the 600s, right, especially when the caliphates were in existence, talk about the Crusades and things like that, you know, that can bring back, if you're talking about trying to create a new form of nationalism, a sense of traditionalism too, of when the area was great, right, before Britain was involved, before World War One, before the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and all of that. And that's interesting. It's out of scope for this. And a lot of people probably understand what it is that I'm getting at here. Shriners, yes. But when we start getting into traditionalism, there's capital T and lower T. I'm talking about lower T. But that can go a lot of different ways if we're looking at the modern context, especially on social media and how these events are operationalized or hijacked or utilized for other purposes, right? But just in general, this idea of Islamic revolution and the concept that you can have a religious anti-imperialism or conservative anti-imperial, right-wing anti-imperialism, anti-colonial action too. On a podcast that's called Today Explain, there was an explanation that was given that I found interesting enough to put down. It was from Khalib Al-Haroub, who's a professor at Northwestern University in Qatar. And so he was discussing the Hamas during the era of the first Intifada and how it was birthed. And I think his explanation was good. So in quotes, he said, "That was kind of a very challenging moment for the Palestinian Muslim Brothers, the Brotherhood. Until that moment, we didn't have something called Hamas. So they faced this choice. Either they refrain from participating in the uprising, and in that case, they're going to lose their membership, they're going to lose face, they're going to lose status within the Palestinian community, or they change their strategy and they gear up from charity into something meaningful in the eyes of the Palestinians. And what's meaningful? Resistance." Right? So it's interesting talking about, you know, how can these groups morph and what causes change. And so here we have an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood being the Islamic Center and a charity organization, but then the world around them changed with the First Intifada and they began to lose membership, credibility, relevancy as people turn to direct action, essentially. And so out of those changing dynamics came Hamas. And a follow-up question to that, to this professor, was, you know, what, when you say resistance, what does resistance mean to Hamas? And in quotes, within the Palestinian, let's say, context and language, it means using all means against the occupation. This could be violent means. This could be nonviolent means. For the Palestinians, they say all these means are justified, and that, you know, there's international law and resolutions that would allow and justify using force and military force against any occupier, any in any part of the world. And so I'm not reading that to agree or disagree, and neither was the professor saying that that's accurate or not, but instead it's a glimpse into the worldview. And that type of rhetoric we'll see later, not in this episode, maybe the next one, but most likely the one after that, if I can keep things under wraps. That point of view is still inherent in Hamas, whether we're talking about communications on Telegram channels from Al-Aqsa Brigades, or whether we're talking about publicly facing politicians that are tied to Hamas. Those core concepts are still there. That what they're doing is not terrorism, that what they're doing is should be protected under international law as fighting against occupation, but it's not, right? And so when we get to the justifications in Hamas's eyes of October 7th, that's going to be some of what's being said. So there's another explanation too, and this wasn't sourced from anything, this is just an observation by me, so take it for what it's worth. But around the same time, there was a group that was becoming more influential in the region called the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and they still exist. The PIJ, they work with Hamas now. But it was also an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. So another organization that wasn't necessarily connected to the Islamic Center, but that had roots in the Brotherhood, went a very, very, very different way, right? And it's interesting because the way in which the Palestinian Islamic Jihad went is a very similar path as Hamas. And I don't know, but I don't wonder if Hamas maybe took some cues from them. So the Palestinian Islamic Jihad were influenced by the Iranian Revolution. And that's important too, because, you know, we start seeing influences from other groups get involved with this. Let me get to them. Yeah, there we go. And the other groups in the area we'll talk about a little bit, though, are Iran and Syria versus maybe the broader Middle East, specifically Saudi Arabia. And so without, you know, getting into geopolitics, it's insightful to understand that there is a lot more going on than just Hamas and the Likud government in Egypt, or in Israel. You know, there's we'll talk about it a little bit when we talk about justifications for October 7th, but there are geopolitics involved as well. So the Palestinian Islamic Jihad was influenced by the Iranian Revolution. They also have an armed military wing called the Al-Quds Brigades. They have some ties to Syria themselves. So it's a similar organization where you have this political organizational front, as well as having a military wing. The Islamic resistance and the connection to Iran, I think, is very interesting, especially if we're talking about the 1980s, because the Iranian Revolution wasn't that long before. And the Iranian Revolution itself, not saying this that I agree with it or disagree with it, but in its own wording, it was an anti-colonial, anti-imperialist revolution against what was, you know, seen as a puppet government. And what took its place was a government with very firm roots in Islam. So the PIJ saw this, and eventually we'll see, like, Hamas began to be influenced by this as well, maybe at first indirectly, but then later when they start meeting up with Hezbollah more directly. So talking about these other groups, again, without going too far off topic, because we're really supposed to be talking about influences in the mind of Hamas to perpetrate October 7th. There is this kind of group, right? There's the Axis of Resistance as well as the Alliance of Palestinian Forces. The Alliance of Palestinian Forces is interesting because it's essentially a group of Palestinian organizations that oppose the Oslo Accords. And Hamas was involved with that, as well as the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and some other groups like the Palestinian Liberation Front. So there's geopolitics involved. There's Syria and Iran. But then there's also this schism within the Palestinian groups of how to move forward with peace, or is peace something that we're really trying to obtain, right? Or is this armed revolution that we're wanting? And that's interesting, too, when we start to get into conversations about ceasefire. Is ceasefire what an organization like the Palestinian Liberation Front really wants if we're talking about moving towards a peace process, right? And I have some very interesting things on that, especially from some communist sources. Not going to get to today, but we'll tease that. But there were some Marxist groups in the region. However, I feel compelled to talk about their waning significance because the significance of them is far outweighed on social media, especially in the West, than what was actually occurring on the ground in the region. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, funding really dried up for the PFLP, which was the main kind of Marxist organization. There are many other offshoots, the DFLP being probably secondary. So PFLP had to find funding from other sources. So think about Iran and Syria again. As dwindling resources went away, they began working with Islamic forces. And when we're talking about operational events, they partook in October 7th, along with the Al-Aqsa brigades, as well as the Al-Quds brigades. And politically speaking, they really had little relevancy. They had 3 seats in the Palestinian Legislative Council in 2006, which was really the last time that council existed, because then we had what amounted to a civil war with Fatah and Hamas, and then Hamas rule. So along with that, there's other secular nationalist groups that were maybe more akin to the Ataturk regimes in Turkey. All of this taken into account, I think that it helps to illustrate the differentiation of Hamas, right? It was another camp that was basically saying to the Muslim world that they weren't being Muslim enough, right? They weren't being religious enough. And that if Muslims reconnected with Islam, then perhaps they could regain the glory of the past and some of the things that I was talking about with traditionalism and nationalism and looking back to the caliphates and referencing Sharia law and things like that. So it's not going back in time, right, trying to restore history, but it's forging a new nationalism, and it's forging new movements and anti-imperialisms in their views, along with finding an identity for themselves. And the identity for these groups, it just didn't happen to end up being Marxism or communism per se. It didn't really even necessarily go down to ethnicity, although there is pan-Arab discussions as well, and that's interesting when you get to Persia. But yeah. But when we're talking about this, that made me lose my train of thought there. That's good. But when we're talking about this, though, there is this idea of echoing the Iranian Revolution, right? And that the way that we fight off colonialism is that we retake our society, our culture, our government, and the way in which we do that is through Islam. Speaking to that, Hamas published a charter in 1988. And it's one of those things that you need to talk about because it's important. However, there's a lot of arguments about how important it is, at least if we're talking about today. So because it's significant, but I want to hold off on saying this is what Hamas is, because there's been a lot of documents publicly facing from Hamas since then that is very counter to this. That's much more secular. However, again, if you get to the chatter of what's going on their Telegram channels, and you can even access some of their websites still, amazingly, there is still anti-Semitism mixed in with it too. So it's a mixed bag. But Hamas published a charter in 1988, a few years after its formation, called the Covenant of the Islamic Resistance Movement. And the charter defined the struggle to be against Jewish people, not specifically Zionists. It called out an eventual creation of an Islamic Palestinian state. It talked about the necessity of destroying Israel in order to do this, creating an Islamic theocracy. The method in which that revolution would occur would be through jihad, and that negotiation with Jewish representatives or Palestinians involved with that were unacceptable. And so I have some quotes up here that you can look at, but there are credible sources that kind of say this was created by a few people involved in the movement, and then a few years after it was kind of put to the side. Since then, it's been updated. 2017, there was specifically some. And I want to talk about the propaganda of Hamas that's more modern. There is propaganda that came out specifically about October 7th, which I think is applicable. We won't get to it in this one, but it's something that, you know, we need to talk about because it exists. And so all of that, this idea of jihad and of destruction of Israel to create an Islamic theocratic state, is in juxtaposition to Fatah. And that's really the main reason to talk about it. It's not to say, you know, this about Hamas. It's more to juxtapose them to what Fatah was doing at the time. So Fatah was engaged in diplomatic attempts to create two states, which had failed since the initial idea, really, going back to 1947 with the United Nations partition plan for Palestine, or going all the way up to the Oslo Accords in the 90s or the Camp David summit. However, Fatah, for much of that time, going up into the 80s, was the main player. And yes, there were many, many offshoots of it and paramilitaries, and you know, there was Islamic fundamentalism involved, but Fatah was really, if we're looking at it as a political organization, at least more secular than what was going on with Hamas later. So we had this juxtaposition, and then something really big kind of happened that impacted Hamas. And so the thing that happened was the mass deportation of 1992. So 400 Palestinians were deported to the Lebanese border to disrupt Hamas. That was the official justification by Israel. It backfired in terms of publicity. And in the initial 2 weeks of December of that year, kind of what caused this was the murder of some Israeli security forces members. Hamas took responsibility for that. After that, Israel detained upwards of 1,600 Palestinians, deporting these 400 or so to the border. So it's important because it was clearly an act of collective punishment. It was against international law for sure. However, the mass deportation of many members of Hamas allowed them to become familiar with Hezbollah, because Hezbollah at that point and still being based in Lebanon. So in this very interesting way, the deportation introduced Hamas to Hezbollah in a much more direct and connected way. And from Hezbollah, Hamas learned tactics like suicide bombing, which they then adopted and began engaging in afterwards. So the failure of the peace process to realize anything meaningful, after decades of what is seen by Hamas as occupation and resistance, that inability of Fatah to realize, you know, much change on the ground is what allowed for Hamas's arguments, which was compromise and negotiation or losing strategies. That is what allowed it to kind of gain foothold in the public's mind. You know, as conditions worsened, Hamas became more popular. And if not, really, if genuine peace had occurred with the Palestinian Authority and Israel, then ultimately, what utility does Hamas serve? And if there is peace and there's no need for revolution, again, what utility does Hamas serve? So there's no need for revolution, then there's no need for Hamas. And it's similar to in the Intifada era. What's the utility of a charity when there's an upheaval, an uprising occurring? And again, this is where, you know, Hamas comes from. So it's interesting when you step outside of politics, when you step outside of activism, and you look at this more purely, well, you could keep this politically, but still organizationally speaking, what happens to Hamas if there's no longer conflict? You know, what happens to Hamas if there is a successful two-state solution? You know, understanding where Hamas came from and how they gained legitimacy. And there are other things too. You know, it's some of it was Fatah and how the misappropriation of funds, the lack of governing, the fact that some of their leaders were living abroad and being seen as living in luxury. You know, there are a lot of things that were happening, but for Hamas, you know, it's interesting looking at something like October 7th, because you could say, what did you think you would gain out of doing that? You know, how do you get peace by doing what you did on October 7th and not legitimizing, but understanding what Israel was going to do? And I don't know that anyone understood the measure, the huge, you know, reaction that's currently going on, but you knew that there's going to be a reaction. And I have some interesting quotes about that from Hamas leadership, but it's at this point when we're just building blocks, it's interesting to look at from that organizational standpoint of Hamas was born in conflict of the Intifada, and their solution was Islamic resistance, right? And that helps inform the logic of October 7th, I suppose, right? As opposed to saying, you know, this is not going to get you into the door for diplomatic talks. So this rejection of a two-state solution, even in a declaration of accepting borders, which it has done in the past, Hamas has said, we'll agree to you know, the 67, 68 borders. But then in the same breath, you know, let's say, but we won't recognize Israel, you know? And there is a critique to that of saying, well, why should you acknowledge your oppressors? And that's, you know, I'm not going to comment on that, but understanding not doing that is also going to shut off the possibility because Israel's not going to engage, right? So it's just a no-go. Again, not saying either is right or wrong, but that's just the political reality of the situation. So really, Hamas, by doing that, even if they do make a, you know, they'll say things like, you know, well, we can talk about borders, they're really not accepting a two-state solution, right? That's the end game and what it is that they're doing. So denunciation of diplomatic agreements in favor of revolutionary action, including violence, is a part of what they are. And it doesn't necessarily stop with just Israel, because there's also a willingness to fight and kill other Palestinians as well. And especially if you're viewing things from the lens of Hamas and you look at Fatah, they are, could be argued to be a counter-revolutionary organization, right? In that they're willing to do all the things that Hamas is saying you cannot do because it doesn't work, right? And we've been through this before in the past. And, you know, this is interesting because when we talk about things such as conflict in the area and the civil war that occurred in 06 and in 07, there was the battle for Gaza, for instance, that occurred, and that was Palestinians fighting Palestinians. So it's such a core component of what Hamas is that it can't even, in some ways, I guess you can itself, but there are things that are legitimate to it. I'm going to kind of start wrapping this up. The idea that, you know, it was amazing for Palestinians to see someone like Yasser Arafat on the world stage. And it was amazing and probably very heartening for them to see someone like him winning a Nobel Peace Prize, but then also beginning to slowly understand that nothing is changing on the ground, right? Nothing is happening. And that his organization, right, specifically Fatah was the organization that was governing, and less and less is occurring, to the point in which Hamas and Fatah had essentially a civil war. You know, that gets into the Mecca agreement that I have here, that occurred in Saudi Arabia, in which there was supposed to be a unitary government with Fatah and Hamas, which was rejected essentially by Hamas and devolved into civil war, the battle for Gaza, et cetera, all the things that I just stated. So I'm going to stop there for this live stream. The next live stream, I'll get into Hamas. Well, I'll get into events that led up to October 7th. I don't know if I'm going to get into Hamas's version of the story or not, because I do want to try to keep these under wraps. I even went long on this one for what it is I'm trying to do. But that's kind of like where we're heading. And so just the core ideas out of this, understanding when we start reading things from Alexander Gates, when we start reading things from Hamas, when we start getting into reactions from Hamas about October 7th, now we have like just a very basic foundation of where Hamas came from, just the core beliefs, not specifics in general, right? And maybe some ideas about where the group is going. And, you know, when we say this, Hamas is a huge organization now. And there are people in Hamas, and I say this with some certitude from people I've spoken to, not in Hamas, but in the region, that know exactly what Hamas is and disagree with it. However, collaborate with Hamas because they see Hamas as being the only group that is militarily organized enough to fight the IDF, right? So, you know, there are those realities too. So we can't say all of this Hamas, but if we're talking about leadership and if we're talking about maybe the ideas and the core concepts of Hamas, this is all, you know, it's tracking. It's rejecting diplomacy, not out of stubbornness per se, but out of lack of any type of any gains on the ground in their eyes for the people of Gaza or Palestine. It's a group that was born out of conflict. And that's what defined it, is a group that learned from other groups like Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah with ties to Iran and those concepts of anti-colonialism based in Islam. And so when you fast forward and this group all of a sudden is winning elections, they're not only are there many different types of people that associate with this group now, but even within its leadership, there are divisions of what is Hamas. Is Hamas an administrative political organization, or is Hamas a revolutionary organization? And that's kind of what led to the collapse of a unitary government between Fatah and Hamas. And Hamas won, and Hamas has ruled essentially since then. And when we get to concepts of October 7th, that tracks more, right? It has it make a little more sense, I suppose. Not justifying, not saying it's right or wrong. I'm keeping all that out of this for now. Maybe if I have opinions later, I'll talk about them. But just trying to get into the head of Hamas, at least we begin to see the logic that they're employing. Let me see here. Giving them blame or credit still ignores the fact that the Palestinians themselves ultimately had no say either way. It's a complicated issue of what about the Palestinian people, right? Involved in this. And you could say, well, they had an election. And then you could also say, well, that election was a long time ago. And it wasn't as if Hamas won. They won the plurality, you know, and that was, it was after a decade plus of what was of promises that were unfulfilled, right, by the opposition group in Fatah, which was the main PFLP exists, DFLP exists, but I mean, they're really minor. They're single digit seats if we're talking about representation. So, you know, there is all that. And then there is also kind of what I was talking about too, about, you know, where do Palestinian people stand? And are you criticizing Hamas like during this time? Right. I don't know. You know, I'm not Palestinian. I'm not going to speak for Palestinian people. But regardless of who they blame for what's happening, and I'm sure there's many different ideas, as there always is, and there's differentiations in opinion. There is something to be said for these are the people who are fighting, you know, in the eyes of people who are just trying to survive outside of any ideological support or political support or anything else. Before half the population was born. Yeah, there's that too. And I'm gonna wrap on that. You know, everything that, well, not most of the stuff that I just talked about occurred before a good portion of the people currently, well, who knows about the population, but you know, a few months ago, a good percent of the people who are in Gaza weren't even alive during the stuff that I was talking about, right? The population, it tilts extremely youthful and young. So you have people who grew up in these situations, and it's informative because much like in the critique of let's say Western leftism or Western anti-imperialism, if we're looking at people in my era who really came of age before September 11th, I was 20 or 19 or something, you know, but I had already lived and I had already engaged in activism before that. Right. And there was, you know, anti-globalization things happening, World Trade Organization, Seattle, and all that, environmentalism. But my view on events is a little bit different because I was informed by other things. And then September 11th happened and then endless war happened, you know, and there's something to be said about that with people in the West who grew up, right, who are younger than me, beginning their life in that era. And so this is all that they, this is their experience is the United States in endless war. And that's different than boomers who grew up in the Cold War, you know, and much similarly in Palestine, there are people who have grown up really since their, you know, since they were children of just seeing failures of the Oslo Accords, if even that, you know, but no peace process really occurring, you know, and disengagement from Israel, from the Gaza Strip, and the decline of everything in the Gaza Strip since then, from 2006, 2007. You know, all that has to be taken in mind too when we think about Hamas and Hamas's views, because not everyone in Hamas is from the 1980s or the 1990s. You know, leadership, yes, for sure, but not everybody involved. Okay. I'm going to go. So thanks for tuning in. The next one I'm thinking will be sooner. This was good. And this helps me organize my own thoughts and talk through things as well. When I'm working on my other research project that this is affiliated with. So comments help, questions help. You can email me. I love it because it gets me thinking and it provides different points of view. But I do think that the next one will be sooner because a lot of the research is already done. All right. So thanks for joining all. This was fun. I'll see you in a few weeks.